First, I'd like to tell you how much I appreciate being here this morning and being able to present. I'm thankful that we were able to arrive safely and appreciate all your prayers on our trip. I appreciate Johnny for speaking last night in my stead and for having the opportunity today to study with you this topic that's been assigned to me. I love the preacher's study. I love the opportunity to come and present. And I look at it as an opportunity to present things that I've studied and with the opportunity to allow those who study the same topic to raise questions and to raise other viewpoints, because I think that's what the study is all about, for us to be able to discuss in an open and honest way the truth of God's Word, to be able to come to a better clarity. The topic that was assigned to me is concerns Christian liberties, and I enjoyed doing the reading for it, the research for it. This is one of those topics that you read about and read over and over and over again, but each time you read it, you see new things, you see new applications of the teaching, and so that's why it's been interesting to me to study the topic. So we're going to be talking this morning about Christian liberties. And I'd like to begin with a text from 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Verse 9. The Apostle Paul says, "Be careful, however, that the exercise of your freedom does not become a stumbling block to the weak." I'll be reading from the NIV. "Be careful, however, that the exercise of your freedom does not become a stumbling block to the weak." The central passages in the discussion of Christian liberties are 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and Romans chapter 14. And one of the most important first steps in any study of passages like these is to define terms. And so that's what we'd like to do at the very beginning this morning, is to define the word liberty and the word stumbling block. There's two words that are used in these passages that's translated liberty. One of them means to have the power or right to do something. In 1 Corinthians 8 and chapter 9, or rather 1 Corinthians chapter 8 verse 9, this is the word that's used for freedom. Exousia, which means to have the power or the right to do something. And in fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, the word is used in verse 12 and verse 18 in regards to support that Paul was receiving as a preacher of the gospel. It was his right to be able to receive support as a minister of the gospel. That doesn't mean that he had to receive it, but he could receive it if he chose to receive it from the Corinthian brethren or other brethren. Another word that's translated freedom is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 29, where Paul says, "The other man's conscience I mean, not yours, for why should my freedom be judged by another man's conscience?" And that word freedom there, eleutheria, means the freedom to do something, to be free to do something. It's the opposite of bondage, for instance. And putting these two words together then, the idea, the concept of these passages is to have the freedom or the right to choose some particular activity, to choose to do something. To have the freedom or power or right to do something, to make a choice, particularly. What I'd like to do to understand better the word freedom in this context is to contrast it with moral principle. Sometimes it's good to define a term in terms of contrast with the opposite term. And that's what we'd like to do this morning. I'd like you to think for a moment with me about the meaning of moral principle versus the meaning of liberty. Because the two concepts are completely different. They're opposites. A moral principle is the opposite of a liberty. There are two things, though. There's one thing, one quality of these that are shared by these two issues, liberty and moral principle, that is that anytime you consider a liberty or anytime you consider a moral principle, you ought to be able to describe the qualities of that moral principle or describe the characteristics of that moral principle. For instance, if we're talking about a moral principle, thou shalt not commit adultery, for instance, we need to understand what adultery is. We need to be able to define it or define fornication. So anytime you discuss a moral principle, the first thing you have to do is define the descriptive characteristics, and that is the relevant characteristics, those things that are relevantly describe what we're talking about. The same is true of liberties, is you have to do the same thing. You have to define exactly what you're talking about. So you define the descriptive characteristics that are relevant in that particular case. Another thing about a moral principle, something that contrasts a moral principle from a liberty, is that a moral principle always obligates. In fact, a moral principle is often worded in terms of an ought. One ought to observe the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week is a moral principle. One ought to forgive others as they have been forgiven. That's a moral principle. It states an obligation for conduct. Whereas a liberty is a choice implied by the freedom involved. You can choose to do something or you can choose not to do something that's considered a liberty. There's no obligation whatsoever in those terms. A moral principle, too, is universal. That is, when we think of a moral principle, we think of something that should apply to everyone. Everyone ought to do the same thing. Everyone ought to forgive others as they have been forgiven. That's not just for certain individuals or for certain people who find it more easy to forgive. Instead, it's obligating everyone to do it. And if you say something is a moral principle, then what you imply by that is that everyone ought to act the same way that you are acting. Everyone ought to forgive as well as you forgive. By contrast, a liberty is not universal, it's individual. That is, you have the individual right to choose what you would rather do. A moral principle, too, provides the basis for judgment. We can judge one another based on moral principles. We can judge another's conduct and say that person's conduct is right or wrong based on our moral principles, on our moral code. Whereas we're not to judge on the basis of liberties. They're not the basis of liberties. Or rather, they're not the basis for judgment. Liberties are not the basis for judgment. We read in Romans chapter 14, verse 1. Except him whose faith is weak, without passing judgment on disputable matters. One's faith allows him to eat everything, but another man whose faith is weak eats only vegetables. The man who eats everything must not look down on him who does not, and the man who does not eat everything must not condemn the man who does, for God has accepted him. Chapter 14 is about the use of Christian liberties. And Paul clearly states that we're not to judge one another on the basis of liberties. They're not for the basis of judgment. One other contrast that helps us understand the meaning of moral principles is that violating a moral principle is sin. And sin separates you from God. Violating a moral principle will separate you from God because it's sin to violate a moral principle. Whereas liberties have nothing to do with sin. Because liberties do not separate you, neither do they draw you to God. Let's read, for instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Where the Bible says concerning the eating of meat. Verse 8. Chapter 8, verse 8. But food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do. So the exercise of your liberties doesn't bring you closer or draw you away from God. Either one. It has nothing to do with your relationship to God. Whereas the violation of a moral principle will separate you from God because it's sin. So you can see how different moral principles are from liberties. And if you want to raise a question about some issue, whether it's a liberty or whether it's a moral principle, then you can use these as guidelines to determine whether it's a moral principle or whether it's just a liberty. Ask yourself, for instance, if by practicing the practice you have in mind, whether you wish to obligate everyone to act in the same way that you're acting. Let's take, for instance, the eating of meats, because that's actually the subject of these passages, as you know. In 1 Corinthians 10, 1 Corinthians 8, and Romans chapter 14, the Apostle Paul is talking about the eating of meat that had been offered to idols. It appears that, of course, that the Gentiles, when they worshiped idols, would offer meat sacrifices to these idols. And, of course, the idols would not eat the meat because they had no life in them. So the worshipers had to do something with this meat. And so they took the meat and would sell it in the meat market, in the shambles, in the places where people would congregate to buy the meat. And, of course, people who believe, Christians who believe that the idols were nothing, that they had no life or breath in them, that they represented absolutely nothing, could go to the marketplace, buy the meat, and eat it, knowing that they were just exercising a liberty, a choice, whether to eat meat or not eat meat. There were some Christians, though, who, because of their conscience about idolatry, felt that if they were eating the meat, they were worshiping idols. And so they believed that if they ate the meat, they would sin. But eating of meat, Paul says, is a liberty. It's a choice. Now, if, like we said, in trying to determine whether something's a moral principle or a liberty, you have to ask yourself, are you willing to obligate everyone to act in the same way that you act? Or would you be willing to obligate everyone not to eat meat and say that it's a sin not to eat meat? And use the eating of meat as a basis of judging the conduct of other people, the moral conduct of other people. And would you consider that a universal principle for everyone to obey? Or would you rather think that it's a choice, an individual choice that's not for the basis of judgment and has nothing to do with sin? So these are some criteria that can help us determine whether a certain issue is a moral principle or if it's a liberty. And if it's a liberty, then we have the choice to practice it or not. Of course, there's always the problem of confusing liberties with moral principles. And this is what we would like to solve, is we would like to solve the confusion sometimes that it comes about by mixing liberties with moral principles and thinking that some liberties are moral principles and other people thinking that some moral principles are really liberties and choices. So this is the important distinction we want to be able to make. And we should be able to clarify this. And the point is this, is that actually, when somebody makes a liberty into a moral principle, and when they bind it on other people, what's really at fault sometimes is a flaw in interpretation. Because they're taking a subject in the scriptures that it was really meant to give us a choice and making it a law. And that would be a fault of interpretation, because the context itself should be able to show you whether such a thing is a law or a liberty. The Bible, the New Testament, actually distinguishes for us in between moral principles and liberties by the way that it expresses moral principles and by the way it expresses to us liberties. For instance, when the New Testament expresses moral principles to us, it shows that there is obligation. There's something we have to do to be pleasing to God. When the New Testament, for instance, specifies only one way of doing something that we must do, then that one way of doing that thing gives us obligation to follow that method. If the Bible, for instance, teaches us that we ought to sing when we worship God, that's a moral principle. It doesn't teach us that we ought to play musical instruments when we sing. And so by telling us one way of worship, it expressly obligates us to worship God in that way. It gives us a moral principle. When the New Testament expresses obligation in any way, without choice between alternatives, the New Testament is expressing a moral principle to us. And you can make these determinations by looking at the context, looking at the author's intent and purpose. So that's why we say sometimes the problem between confusing moral principles with liberties is a confusion in interpretation, contextual interpretation. The New Testament expresses liberties by giving us a choice in the matters. For instance, there are some passages, for instance, in the scriptures that explicitly give us certain liberties in certain areas. For instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul explicitly gives us liberty about what kind of food we can eat. There's an interesting passage in Acts chapter 5. In Peter's conversation with Ananias and Sapphira about the property that they sold. In chapter 5, verse 4, Peter asks Ananias concerning the property, "Didn't it belong to you before it was sold? And after it was sold, wasn't the money at your disposal? What made you think of doing such a thing? You have not lied to men, but to God." There's an example here of a liberty, and there's also an example of a moral principle. The liberty, of course, was the power that Ananias had to choose what to do with his material resources. He could choose to give all the money that he got from the sale of that property to the apostles for the distribution to the poor, or he could choose to give part of it. That was his choice. And Peter explicitly reminds him of that. "Didn't it belong to you after it was sold? Wasn't this money yours to do with as you pleased?" So he could make that decision. We have that liberty too in our own Christian life. We have a liberty to use our material resources in certain ways, to make choices about how we use our material resources. Also, in the same passage, in the same verse, we find a moral principle mentioned, and that moral principle is not to lie to God. And that's an obligation. No one is to lie to God. That's a universal moral principle that is an obligation for us, a moral obligation. There is one way. And this is an interesting point. There is one way that moral principles and liberties come together, and that moral principles, sometimes there are moral principles that provide the limits for how we exercise our liberties. That is, for instance, talking about the use of our material resources. You cannot say that we could use our material resources in any way whatsoever we might please, because there are certain limitations for the use of our material resources, certain moral principles that help us understand how we should use our material resources. For instance, the parable of the talents teaches us that we're stewards for what God has given to us, and He will hold us accountable for being faithful servants. And so how we spend our resources should reflect our faithfulness as a steward to God. Nonetheless, we still have choices we can make about what kind of car we're going to buy, what kind of house we're going to build, what kind of clothes we're going to buy, and so on. But within limits. And those moral principles provide those limits. There was a brother one time years ago who told me he was talking about the house he was going to build. And he was going to build a large house with a large living room. And he said to me, "I'm going to build this house, this large house, but I'm going to build it for the brethren. Because I always want the brethren to come and visit me and stay with me, and I want to provide places for them to stay during meetings." And that's what he did. He built a house. This was years ago. He built a house, and I don't know how many hundreds of brethren had stayed with him. But that was his choice, to build a large house. But he made that choice still respecting the limitations that other moral principles give us for the use of our material resources. So, we want to make sure that we decide scripturally, whether something is a liberty or a moral principle, based on the context of the passage we're studying and based on the characteristics of moral principles versus liberties. And so this is what you can do. If you have a question about some aspect of conduct, aspect of Christian conduct, and you want to know whether it's a liberty or a moral principle, then you can ask yourself which characteristics it carries. Let's think for a moment about some liberties, some examples of liberties. Christian liberties, of course, in the New Testament involve the eating of meat or the eating of food. That was their choice, as well as our choice today, to decide what kind of food we're going to eat. And in all things, give thanks to God. Circumcision was an example of a Christian liberty. Paul decided that it would be useful for Timothy to be circumcised. And so Timothy was circumcised. I'm sure Timothy has some choice in that matter too, but they made that choice based on how well it would be how well he would be accepted among the Gentiles and among the Jews too at the same time. And as we said, another more example of a liberty is here in Acts chapter 5 concerning the eating of, concerning the use of our material resources. Today there are innumerable examples of Christian liberties that we can see are a matter of our own individual choice. What kind of job we work at is a Christian liberty we have. My father was a contractor, a commercial contractor, and he mainly did renovations in industrial buildings. And I remember one conversation that a person had at church with him one day when I was young. I still remember this conversation that this person had with my father, because he was doing some building in a company, an aerospace company in Los Angeles that also had defense contracts. And what he was doing was building foundations for some of the large machinery in this aerospace company. And so the person thought that my dad was sinning by doing work for an aerospace company because they had defense contracts. But I think that's a liberty. It's a liberty still within the limitations of moral principles, but it's nonetheless our job. What kind of job we have is a Christian liberty that we can choose, or that something we can choose. Whether we marry or not is another example of a liberty. How many children we have is a liberty. How to organize worship services is a liberty. How many songs we're going to sing is a Christian liberty, something we can decide by choice, because the New Testament doesn't teach us how many songs we're to sing. It teaches us that we are to sing, but it doesn't teach us how many songs we're to sing. It doesn't teach us whether those songs should come from a book or they should come from our memory. Those things are left up to our individual decision. And so as a congregation, we determine what kind of choice we're going to make, cooperating together. And so those are Christian liberties. It's a liberty to you. It's your choice where you want to be baptized. If you want to be baptized in a stream or a river or the ocean or a baptistry, that's your choice. But the moral principle is that you ought to be baptized. You must be baptized to be saved. The where is your choice. There's many liberties, countless liberties we could talk about, but you get the idea. You get the point that a liberty is something the Bible gives us the choice on. The choice is left to us either explicitly or implicitly in the Scriptures. Now I'd like to talk for a moment about how sometimes our exercise of liberty might cause someone to stumble. And again, it's important to understand the meaning of words, the definition of words. The King James Version uses the word offense, and sometimes this has led to confusion because the word offense at that time in the New Testament, or rather the word that was translated offense, does not mean that, or have the same idea that the word offense has today in our modern language, our vocabulary today. To offend somebody usually means that you vex them, that you frustrate them, that you hurt them in some way emotionally. But that's not what the word that's translated offense or stumbling block in the Scriptures mean. Actually, there are three words that are translated in the Scriptures, stumbling or stumbling block. And they all come together basically in the same meaning. And that is to cause somebody to fall into sin. There's one particular word, scandalizo, which in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 13, we'll read that passage that we... 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 13. He says, therefore, if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause him to fall. This is an interesting word because it means to set a trap for somebody, as if your exercise of your liberty somehow sets a trap for somebody to fall into sin. But it's so important to understand the meaning of the word stumbling block or stumbling. It means to cause someone to fall into sin. And the way you cause them to fall into sin, according to the contextual meaning given in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 1 Corinthians chapter 10, is that when you exercise your liberty, your choice, another brother who sees you make your choice and exercise your liberty imitates your behavior. He does the same thing. But his conscience is not as well educated as your conscience. He doesn't have the same degree of knowledge that you have. And so when he exercises the same choice that you exercise, because he doesn't have an educated conscience, he doubts that he's doing the right thing. And he sins because he doubts. And that's how he stumbles or falls. It's not that he's vexed or frustrated by your behavior, but instead he imitates your behavior and by so doing wounds his conscience, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 12. Read with me, he says, "When you sin against your brothers in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ." So there he explains contextually the meaning of causing somebody to stumble. You wound his conscience. Well, what is the conscience, by the way? The conscience is this power that we have to judge our own actions, to determine whether they're right or wrong. And when we do something wrong, our conscience accuses us. It's a mental power that we have to accuse us of having done something wrong. And God has given us this mental ability to protect us from sin. Because when our conscience reminds us that what we're doing is wrong, we feel bad about it. We feel guilty about it. And so our conscience has the power to motivate us to not sin. Now, when a person, for instance, in a context, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, who believes that by eating the meat offered to idols is a sin, he would sin by eating the meat offered to idols, he sees another brother who eats the meat, and he says, well, I guess it's all right. And so he eats the meat. But when he eats the meat, he's still not sure that it's right to eat meat offered to idols. And because he doubts, or maybe because he even thinks that he might have sinned by doing it, his conscience is wounded. And the brother who has given him the example is guilty of wounding his conscience or causing him to fall into sin. That's specifically what the passage is talking about. It's not talking about vexing somebody, frustrating somebody, or making them emotionally distraught because of your behavior. Of course, that may be wrong for other reasons, but it's not wrong because of what Paul says in these passages. It's interesting to also to contrast this with how Jesus was a stumbling block to the Jews. Because the Bible says that Jesus was a stumbling block to the Jews, not by the exercise of his liberties, by the way, but because of who he was as the Messiah. Because Jesus was a stumbling block to the Jews, they rejected him. And he was a stumbling block to them in this way, that they had a certain concept or view of the Messiah. And Jesus didn't fit that view of the Messiah. And so some Jews thought that if they accepted Jesus, they would be sinning. And by accepting Jesus, they would go against their understanding of what the Messiah would be and go against Jehovah's word and go against God. And so for that reason, because of their lack of understanding of the scriptures and of the prophecies, they felt that if they followed Jesus, they would sin against God. But it was because of their lack of knowledge that Jesus was a stumbling block to them. Not because of Jesus' exercise of his liberties was he a stumbling block to them, but because of the truth that he taught. So actually, it's possible that we could cause people to stumble for other reasons besides the exercise of our liberty. But that's not the point of this passage. The point of this passage is by the exercise of our liberties, we can cause somebody to stumble or fall into sin because when they do it, they don't have the same understanding or knowledge that we have. Next, I'd like to talk about mention some examples that come to my mind of liberties, modern-day liberties, and how sometimes they cause people to stumble, or they might cause people to stumble. And the problem sometimes in mentioning examples of liberties, of course, is that we disagree on what liberties are, and that's part of the problem, right? That's always going to be the problem, because you're always trying to determine whether a liberty is a moral principle or a moral principle is a liberty. And so that's okay, as long as we're willing to always talk about it and study about it and think about it and search the scriptures about it. That's okay because by disagreement we come together, we talk, we discuss, and we can resolve those kinds of conflicts with some sort of method for resolving them. But it's inevitable that we disagree about what liberties might be. in my particular viewpoint, the use of the version that you use, the version of the New Testament, is a liberty. You can decide which version you want to use. That's your choice. Of course, there are certain moral limitations within that realm, and that is, I don't believe I could use a version that is not faithful to the original text. But I still believe that we can make choices about which versions we use. But, say for instance, I use the NIV, and somebody sees my example, somebody that's within my realm of influence sees my example, and is not certain about my use of, sees me use the NIV, uses the NIV, but doesn't have knowledge, doesn't have enough sufficient knowledge about translations, and thinks when they use the NIV, start reading from it, that they might be sinning by using a different translation. That might be an example of causing somebody to stumble. But it would not be an offense if they were simply vexed and frustrated by my use of the NIV version. I wouldn't be offending them in the scriptural sense. But let me raise another point about offense and liberty in this case too. Is that normally contextually in these passages, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Romans chapter 14, Paul is talking about offense, or rather the use of liberties, and whether we cause somebody to stumble or not, by talking about personal relationships we have with people around us, because those are the people we influence. Right? He's not talking about how my conduct influences somebody 2,000 miles away and influences them. Rather, he's talking about people within my influence, my realm of influence, because I have to know, I have to be aware of my liberty, whether my liberty is actually causing somebody to stumble or not. And it's impossible for me to be aware that my liberty is causing somebody to stumble 2,000 miles away. I might come into that knowledge by communication. But the kinds of relationships that Paul is talking about here in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 1 Corinthians chapter 10 are local relationships. That's an important thing to remember. Because I have to be able to know my brother and whether I am causing him to sin or not to sin. There are other ways, of course, to deal with these issues too, besides just creating conflicts about them. We'll talk about that in a moment. Another example, for instance, would be an example that came to my mind recently in my own work and among Hispanic people, is that let me back up for a second. I teach classes at a juvenile hall in California, in Salinas, moral education, character education classes for the adult school there. And I deal with a lot of gang members. And some of the gang members I get to know over a period of time, because I work with them over a long period of time, a year or 2 years sometimes. And one particular gang member that I had gotten to know very well got out of juvenile hall after being in there for a year and a half. We had some great discussions together. And I really believe that he was ready to leave the gang, but I wanted to follow him up. While I was in Russia, he got out of juvenile hall. Actually, right before I went to Russia in October, he got out of juvenile hall, and I saw him in the store, and he introduced me to his mom. He was with his mom, and that's really a big deal, you know, for a gangbanger is to even admit he has a mom, let alone introduce his mom to his teacher. But I really felt like that was a kind of a breakthrough in communication. And so when I was in Russia, somebody shot and killed him. Till it affects me. So I decided, out of respect for him and respect for his mother, to attend the funeral, which was a Catholic mass, of course. But I did so by sitting in the back. I didn't stand up. I didn't recite the prayers, but I went there, and I did show respect for him and his family. I was the only white person there. And I was the only person, in fact, that went up to his mother and talked to his mother, because all the rest of the people there, mostly there was probably 200 people there, and probably 150 of them were gang members at the funeral. But, you know, what could happen, I have to be very careful about this, and that is that Some Christians that we work with are from a Catholic background. And for them to go back into a Catholic church and to sit down during a Mass, they would feel would be a sin to them. And so I had to be careful when I explained to them what I did was I had to explain to them that I sat down in the back, that I didn't participate, but I just did it to show respect for them. But there was the possibility of my liberty, my choosing to go and attend that, to cause somebody to sin by seeing my example and thinking then that they could go to a Catholic wedding or a Catholic Mass and sit down and participate. And when they were and if they went and they were inside, they would feel like they were sinning. And so that's an example of how our choice could influence somebody else in that way. So there's a couple of examples. Another example might be watching television or watching a movie. If I'm careful about watching a movie or watching television and choose good programs to watch, and another member who is not as strong, doesn't have as much knowledge, sees my example, but watches a movie that's not a good movie for Christians to watch, and sins, then I've cast a snare or a stumbling block for that person. So I need to be aware of how my influence affects brethren in a local sense, and whether or not my conduct, my choice of liberties, causes them to stumble. There's always the alternative. The first alternative, of course, is education. I can educate my brethren in what the truth is. But even after educating my brethren, if they still have a doubt about it, and if they're still, if it still might be a case where they would fall into sin by participating in that, then I have to abstain from that liberty. But remember, and this is a key point about the exercise of liberty, is that I cause my brother to stumble when he participates in that activity and thinks he's sinning. I don't cause him to stumble in this sense of the word, in these passages, when he simply is vexed by my behavior. But instead, I cause him to stumble when he sees my example, imitates the example, but doesn't have the knowledge that I have, and thinks that he sins when he participates in that activity. Next, I'd like to talk about what I would call the paradoxes of liberty. A paradox is something that surprises us, that it's a conclusion that is unexpected. One paradox about liberties is that the one who thinks he is strong sometimes is really the one who is weak. Because sometimes it is the person who believes, for instance, in the context of the scriptures, the person who believed that he could not eat meat off of the idols would think he would be strong for not worshiping idols, for standing against idolatry by not eating meat offered to idols. But in reality, he's weak. He's weak because he doesn't have knowledge. The knowledge he needs to understand that the idols are nothing, that they have no value whatsoever. Another paradox of liberties is that a person sometimes is condemned for the exercise of a liberty, for committing sin, instead of approved for exercising a liberty. In other words, the paradox is this, that, as Paul puts it, we'll read in just a moment what Paul has to say about this, but as the paradox is this, that you're condemned not for having committed sin, but in reality, having exercised a liberty. Condemned for the exercise of a liberty instead of committing an actual sin. For instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 29, this is what Paul says. He says in verse 29 and 30, "The other man's conscience, I mean, not yours, but why should my freedom be judged by another man's conscience? If I take part in the meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of something I thank God for?" So that's a paradox to Paul. It's something that it's not really logical, that he should be condemned for participating in something that he can give thanks for. So that's the paradox. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians, in Romans chapter 14, verse 3, that the one who eats should not condemn the one who does not eat. And the one who does not eat should not condemn the one who does eat. Because liberties are not the basis for judgment. 5 minutes. Okay, thank you. It reminds me of an example. You know, going back to the use of versions, I don't mean to bring up versions to be controversial, but I think it's an issue of liberties, right? It's a good example, a good present example of the choices we make, right? And one time my support was cut, you know, because I was using the NIV version. One congregation decided not to support me because I was using the NIV version. That's fine with me, right? If that's their choice, that's their choice. That's their liberty, and that didn't offend me, really. Because that's their choice. They can exercise that choice. But nonetheless, it presented a paradox to my thinking because there are certain people that I work with that are not completely fluent in English and not completely fluent in Spanish, and the best thing I can do is find a very readable version in English for them to be able to read the Bible and read the Scriptures. And so here I am preaching the Word of God, converting souls, and being condemned. But being condemned by someone who's not converting souls, who's not preaching the gospel. And that to me is a paradox. It doesn't, like I said, it does not offend me, but it's a paradox. Another paradox, a third one I want to mention, is that the weak can actually offend the strong. It's possible that a weak person could offend the strong. We're talking, this passage always talks about the strong offending the weak, but it is possible for the weak person to offend the strong person. Let me give you an example about versions, for instance. If I said, okay, the local brethren here don't want me to use the NIV version, and so I will not use the NIV version. But then I go to study with somebody, and I'm struggling to help them understand the Scriptures, and they can't understand the Scriptures, and in their daily Bible reading from a version they can't understand, they can't come to a better knowledge of the Scriptures reading on their own, I feel like I'm doing something wrong. I'm withholding the Scriptures from them, and I would feel like I would be sinning. I believe women can hold private Bible studies, not public teaching, but private Bible studies. And if somebody said, well, it saw that example, and then they decided women could hold private Bible studies too, but then when they organized them, they had some doubts in their mind still, and even though they were doing it, they felt that they might be sinning, then they would be they would stumble in the sense that we've been talking about here. But nonetheless, if I said, okay, we won't have any women hold any private Bible studies, they can't talk to anybody about the gospel. If I said that, then I think I would be sinning. Because I would limit in an unscriptural way what women can do for God. So, the last thing I want to mention, just briefly, because we don't have time for it, but what happens... I'll raise this as a question, you know, and we won't have much time to do with it. But what happens, this is a question that's raised frequently, is what happens when one person holds everyone else hostage to their own liberties, their own choices, their own opinions? What happens when a brother has made certain choices, but believes those choices are moral principles and teaches them as moral principles when in reality they're liberties? What happens in such a case? How are we to deal with that kind of situation? Is it just a matter of saying, well, if somebody's bothered by it, give it up? No. Not at all. In the first place, these passages are not talking about people who are bothered by things. And actually, the brother who takes a liberty and makes it into a moral principle and then preaches it as if it were a moral principle is not going to participate in that thing himself anyway. And so there's not a possibility that he would stumble by participating in it, because he's not going to participate in it. He stubbornly refuses to do it. And that's why he preaches a liberty as a moral principle. So that's not even a question of whether he's stumbling or not stumbling. Instead, it falls within the realm of what Paul has to say about divisive people in Titus chapter 3, verse 10. The heretic, or the divisive person, is a person, actually, who takes his choices and binds them on other people. In fact, the word heretic comes from a word whose root meaning is to make choices. And so a heretic is somebody who takes his, what should be choices, and binds them on others to create division. and such a certain person should be rejected. In Acts chapter 15, there's an example of how they dealt with liberties too in the church, in the early church, when certain people wanted to hold all the rest hostage to their opinions concerning circumcision. The Jews wanted the Gentiles to be circumcised. They were taking a liberty, making a moral principle out of it, and commanding that everyone should be circumcised. All the Jews, the Gentile males should be circumcised. And so what should they do? That was the question that the apostles were to consider in Jerusalem in Acts 15. And what did they say? Not to bind circumcision on the Gentiles.